Hello, this is On Science, a podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. I'm Andrew Prince. This week, we'll bring you the story of a tiny marine creature with incredibly sharp teeth, the 2010 edition of Last Year Was the Warmest Year on Record, and a story about researchers studying penguins. And the tags they use to track them. But first, a year ago in the Haitian city of Port-au-Prince, a magnitude 7 earthquake turned the city into a death trap. Earthquake engineers say many casualties could have been avoided if buildings had been built better. Now, engineers are trying to improve construction standards as Haiti rebuilds. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, though, it will take more than good engineering to rebuild Haiti.
In Port-au-Prince, there's so much rubble on sidewalks that people walk in the street. Everywhere, buildings sag in a state of semi-collapse. When engineer Pierre Fouché returned there after the quake, he hardly recognized his hometown.
When I got there, it was a shock. Basically, it was like I lost all of my landmarks.
When the quake hit, Fouché was studying earthquake engineering at the University of Buffalo in New York. He knew that Haiti lacked building codes, that people built houses on steep hillsides or on soft ground, that they used shoddy materials, and now he fears the city will rebuild the same way.
Some people, they are simply starting to reconstruct their homes because they need some place to live in. And this is actually tragic.
Tragic because the country lacks people who know how to build for earthquakes. At the time of the quake, Fouché says he was Haiti's only quake engineer.
We don't know when the next one is going to happen. And if we don't want to have 300,000 people dying, I think this is something that has to be done. At some point, the government will have to do it.
The government has not, however. So quake engineer André Filiatro at the University of Buffalo has organized quake seminars for Haitian engineers. Filiatro says most of the masonry buildings he's seen in Haiti cannot handle the side-to-side shaking that a quake creates. The walls develop cracks and then holes.
And if you have too much of a hole in the wall, then it can't support the slab above, and that's where all these slabs collapse on top of each other, which we call pancake collapse.
Filiatro says you can fix that cheaply with something called confined masonry. You build a cinder block wall, and at each end, the blocks are set like a vertical row of teeth, with every other one missing. Then you pour concrete down and over that row of teeth to make vertical columns that anchor the wall.
You cast your column into the wall such that it's an integral part of the wall. So basically the wall becomes interlocked into the column.
Techniques like this are simple, but there are few building codes in Haiti and little enforcement. What there is poverty and corruption. Roger Billum is a seismologist at the University of Colorado who studied the past 30 years of earthquakes. He says poverty and corruption kill because they undercut construction standards. People cheat.
You can go to a collapsed building with a hammer or a screwdriver and test the quality of the cement. If you can put your screwdriver in and write your name in it, obviously the cement is completely inadequate.
In a study in the journal Nature, Billum says 83% of quake deaths from building collapse have happened in countries that were especially corrupt, where bribes were paid, for example, to overlook code violations. In Haiti, Billum says it wasn't so much corruption as poverty that doomed so many buildings, but he suspects that may change as money to rebuild pours into the country.
The corruption that does exist in the form of bribery, shortcuts, inexpensive materials and so on, I'm sure that's going to kick in. People are going to do whatever they can.
Filiatro's training group, organized by the University of Buffalo, is hoping to convince Haitians to demand better buildings. Recently, the Haitian Ministry of Public Works asked Filiatro if their engineers could get training too, and the government has just issued voluntary guidelines for better building practices. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
A tiny marine creature might hold the key to better artificial teeth and bones. This rather unexpected possibility comes from a relatively new branch of science called biomaterials. These are materials that are inspired by what plants and animals make, but tweaked to make useful new products. As NPR's Joe Palca reports, before you can copy what animals do, you have to understand how they do it.
If you think about it, it's rather remarkable that creatures with squishy insides like oysters and clams can make rock-hard shells, and creatures with squishy insides like us can make bones and teeth. Derek Uster of Northwestern University is interested in how soft things make hard things, so he studies the chitin.
The chitin is a sea creature. It belongs to the mollusks that the bivalves, so the clams and the snails, belong to.
Chitins are small, rather flat, and oval in shape. The chitin Uster studies is called Chitoplura apiculata, and it has a rather odd way of getting a meal.
This particular organism literally chews rock in order to feed.
It grinds down rock to get at algae and other food particles that might be sandwiched in the rock.
And for that, it needs incredibly tough and hard teeth.
In fact, Uster says chitin teeth are one of the hardest and toughest materials known in nature.
They also have a very particular structure that allows them to self-sharpen to a certain degree.
A trick Uster would like to be able to replicate in the lab.
Imagine, you know, a knife that keeps its edge forever.
But before you can contemplate making such a thing in the lab, you need to know how the chitin does it.
For that, we're using one of the most powerful microscopes, the so-called atom probe.
He focuses this microscope at the place where the soft organic molecules of the chitin's innards are shaping the rock-hard inorganic minerals of the chitin's teeth.
The microscope really works by plucking a sample apart.
Essentially, one atom at a time. As he reports in the journal Nature, Uster says they're now getting a better handle on how the chitin uses organic proteins to form tiny pockets that the hard inorganic minerals grow into to make sharp, hard teeth. Lara Estroff is impressed.
This is an unprecedented level of detail.
Estroff is a professor of materials science and engineering at Cornell University. When materials scientists try to make things in the lab, they frequently have to resort to high temperatures and extreme pressures to force materials into useful shapes. And yet, Estroff says the chitin is able to make its remarkable teeth in regular old seawater and with no special equipment. That's why they're worth studying. Estroff says the key to understanding how they do it is where the soft and hard parts come together.
Anywhere from mollusk shells to teeth to bone, there's always an organic scaffold upon which the inorganic crystals get grown.
She says Uster's atom probe microscope gives a detailed picture of how those scaffolds form.
What's really cool about this is not only do they image it, but they get composition information as they image it.
And that should help scientists take what they've learned from how chitins and other creatures make remarkable structures such as shells and teeth and use that to make new biomaterials in the lab. Derek Uster says it's not all that surprising that primitive creatures like chitins have developed some clever tricks, such as making self-sharpening teeth.
Nature has had 500-odd million years of a head start in product development, and so they have been able to find some really creative and efficient solutions to engineering problems.
Engineering problems such as making a better artificial hip joint or a better dental implant. And if that doesn't work, creating the truly self-sharpening knife would probably be a top seller on late-night television. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Every January for the past decade, you've heard the same basic news story. It announces that last year was one of the warmest years on the planet since 1880, when record-keeping began in earnest. Well, it's January, and yes, last year was one of the warmest years on record since 1880. In fact, 2010 ties the record with 2005 as the hottest year in the historical record. NPR's Richard Harris has the 2011 edition of our story.
This year, it was Deke Arndt's turn to break the news in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's annual teleconference. And you already know what he announced.
This continues a trend that has gone on for several decades. This is the 34th consecutive year with temperatures above the 20th century average.
In fact, you need to go back to 1976 to find a year with below average global temperatures as measured on thermometers around the world. But enough about heat already. What about rain and snow?
Precipitation is highly variable from place to place, so there were lots of dry areas, lots of wet areas, but when we averaged those out, it was also the wettest year on record.
Think of the devastating floods in Pakistan. Now, warm air can hold more water, but Arndt can't say whether there's a direct link between the record-tying heat and the record-breaking precipitation. And these are global averages. Arndt said the story was different for those of us in the United States.
Both the temperature and precipitation were above normal. It was the 23rd warmest year on record in the United States. It was the 36th wettest year on record. These both fall into the upper third of the United States climate history, which dates back to 1895.
Of course, there's a lot of variation across the globe, so it's not at all surprising to see records in some places, but not in others. Last year's global record was due in part to an unusually hot Pacific Ocean caused by a weather pattern called El Niño. John Christie at the University of Alabama in Huntsville sees the same general warming trend in his measurements of global temperature. Those are based on satellite measurements of the planet's air from the surface up to 35,000 feet.
Well, the take-home lesson is if you have an El Niño, you're going to have a hot year. But I just finished shoveling 8 inches of global warming off my driveway this Monday here in Alabama. So whatever the globe is doing, your local weather can have a completely different picture, that's for sure.
And as for the long-term global trend, David Easterling from the National Climatic Data Center in Asheville, North Carolina, says that's our doing, global warming, driven by our emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases.
Although we can't attribute any individual event, such as the Russian heat wave, to climate change, it's always important to keep in mind that the probability of these kinds of events do increase as the climate warms.
And yes, that's the same conclusion you heard from the world's most respected climate scientists in 2010, 2009, 2008, and so on. The story's not changing. Richard Harris, NPR News.
There's nothing quite like a day at the beach with a few thousand penguins. In this case, it's a beach in Argentina. Every year about this time, penguins congregate in the far southern hemisphere to build nests and raise families. You'll also find biologists there, wrapping tags on the penguins' flippers so that they can follow the birds for life. But as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, some scientists now say tagging is too harmful because it undercuts a penguin's most important skill, swimming.
I was lucky enough to stand on a cliff overlooking one of these Argentinian beaches where thousands of Magellanic penguins had gathered. Like awkward mannequins, they waddled down to the water, but when they dived in, they were transformed into black and white torpedoes. Rory Wilson has watched penguins for 30 years.
Even people that work on penguins don't appreciate how stunning they are underwater, how maneuverable and how fast. You know, it's hard to describe it.
Wilson and other scientists have shown that penguins have a very, very low coefficient of drag. That's a measure of how well a body moves through air or water.
If you were shaped like a penguin, you could kick off the side of the swimming pool, then you would just go, you know, gliding for yards and yards and yards.
But Wilson and other biologists say some tags seemed to increase drag and slow down penguins. These tags can be plastic, aluminum, or other metal. They're usually about an inch wide and a few inches long and wrap around the narrow base of a flipper. It's hard to imagine they'd slow down a penguin. Wilson from Swansea University in Great Britain says they do.
Think of it like this. If you had a speedboat or something, and then you took one of your bands and you stuck it to the propeller, would you expect the boat to be able to perform in the same way?
And now, a research team from the University of Strasbourg in France has evidence to back up what Wilson has seen. The French team put traditional metal bands on 50 king penguins that live near Antarctica. 50 others had much smaller radio frequency transponders. 10 years later, the survival rate for banded birds was 16% below the unbanded birds. Yvonne Lamajo was the chief biologist.
In other words, only the super athletes are surviving.
The numbers were worse for breeding. Banded birds produced 39% fewer chicks. Yvonne Lamajo found that banded birds took longer to forage for food in the ocean, and they were slower to get to breeding sites in the spring, so adults had less time to raise their chicks before heading off for lengthy foraging trips in the winter.
At some times they will have to leave, why their cheek is still too young and too poor in body fuels of reserves to withstand the winter.
The study appears in the journal Nature, but the verdict on tags is by no means clear. Other scientists say they've got different results. Among the world's leading penguin experts is Dee Boersma at the University of Washington.
This study shows that the bands that they used on king penguins harmed the king penguins. I have no doubt about that. But all bands are not created equal. It depends on what material that they're made of. It depends on how they're shaped. It depends on how they're fitted to the individual penguin. It depends on what penguin species it is.
Boersma has also studied bands on Magellanic penguins. Aluminum bands were harmful, but stainless steel ones were fine. She says eliminating all tags would be throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
In almost all cases, whenever we do science, we would like to do no harm. But in fact, we do have to do some harm if we want to follow individuals.
And following individual penguins is increasingly important. They are sentinel species that are likely to show the first effects of climate change. And biologists agree they don't want to blame climate change for some effect that's really caused by a bad flipper band. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
That wraps up On Science for this week. We'll be back in your ears next week with more science covered from NPR. I'm Andrew Prince. Have a great week.